Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guests today are.
My name is Peter Bloom. I'm a professor of management and society at the University of Essex, and I am head of the cooperative management and marketing group at the Essex Business School and co-founder with Stephen of the Cover Research Center on commons organizing values, equalities, and resilience.
Hi, I'm Steve Duncombe, and I'm a professor of media and culture at New York University and co-founder and research director of the Center for Artistic Activism.
Hi, I'm Stephen Chakaitis. I work at the University of Essex in the research center that Peter just mentioned, and I also work with the Autonomy Media Editorial Collective based in New York.
Well, welcome to all of you. It's great to have you here, and I'd like to start out with the question that I mentioned to you all, which you can reply to in any way you want. It could be occupational, environmental, familial, geopolitical. And that is to ask what it is, what are the things currently dynamizing, preoccupying, retarding, interesting you? Maybe we could start in the same order, go in the same order just for this bit, and then move out in a slightly more free-flowing way and start with Peter.
Sure. I mean, I think it's a large question, but for me currently, what I'm most interested in, besides my 7-year-old, so I probably the most honest answer sometimes every page is dinosaurs and aliens, but this context, is I'm really interested in what are the ways in which we turn what I think are oftentimes seen as quite idealist or phantasmatic ideas around post-capitalism into value-creating realities. And what I mean by that is not just how they can be implemented or good ideas, but how they actually form kind of multi-scalar models and frameworks for actually improving goods and services that people have. So that when we're looking at these types of ideas, we're not just seeing them as idealist, nor are we seeing them as feasible, but we're also seeing them as rational because they simply work better. And it's easier for us to implement them and access them. So I think that kind of process, which is kind of transvolution process of going from capitalism to post-capitalism in a way that is actually based on making it more value-driven and making what seems radical actually seem quite rational. That would be
And
kind of what I'm
does
most
that
interested
mean
in.
some kind of transformation from exchange value to use value, even in terms of value accorded to objects and services and people and labor and so on?
So I would say absolutely. And I think that there's a wide range of ways in which we turn kind of values into value. And I think part of the process is exactly moving beyond commodification and exploitation as the basis of value. But what I also think is that, and I guess this is a broader discussion, is that there's a dialectical way in which we take some of the core components of what is traditionally seen as capitalist value, which are around efficiency, for instance, easier access, opportunity cost, and actually show the ways in which a more socialized economy and society can actually deliver these in a way that's more egalitarian, more accessible, and ultimately, I think, just more rational. And I do think that in that sense, what we're looking at in terms of value then is a transformation of the substance of value itself, as you've said, but also the ways in which we're able to really kind of in a hegemonic sense co-opt what are existing dominant notions of values and show the paucity of them currently.
And Prof D and then Prof S.
Sure. Yeah, the Stephen and the Stephen are going to be complicated. So I think, working off of what Peter said, I've always been interested in utopia, and particularly in the past, say, dozen years, sort of helping activists to create imaginative spaces in which they can sort of perform a utopia. But then, very importantly, walking it back and thinking about in terms of practical steps. Because if we just kind of go under this sort of utopian place, that's wonderful. Except if we stay there and don't sort of give a pathway there, it's actually, I think, kind of can undermine political activity. It becomes a haven in a heartless world. And so I'm very interested in sort of how do you operationalize utopia? How do you actually make it work, either on the ground or have practical steps to actually get there? The other thing that I think is motivating me in the past week, and this really speaks to a substantive value question, is, and it also speaks to having a child, is I went and visited my son in Glasgow, where he's at uni. And, you know, going from New York to Glasgow is a really interesting experience because value, social value, which really doesn't exist in New York City at this point, is very much in place in a place like Glasgow. It's being undermined, and people I met there kept talking about how it was being undermined. Yet the idea of the social and the importance of the social and the interaction, the social, making time for the social, is very still present in some places and spaces. And then the question is, how do you expand that? And then also, how do you bring it back to a place like New York, the capital of capital?
Cool. I guess sort of what's okay. I should say that my sort of overall shtick, what I've been doing for years and years, is I'm interested in looking at sort of, let's say, various kinds of artistic practices or cultural practices, just trying to unpack the utopian dynamics that can be found within them and try to elaborate that and sort of build from that and then bring it back to those people who are working in those areas. And that's been where they're talking about radical arts or we're talking about autonomous politics. And that's my general stick. But what I've been most excited by in the past few years is, you know, perhaps also stick with the theme of kids, is I never cared about sports growing up. But my son went football mad and I went mad with him. And then I start looking into trying to unpack the utopian politics of the overlap of sports and politics. And so that's what I've been focused on recently for the past a while now.
Perhaps I could just briefly pick up on that, if I may, because one of the interesting things about the difference between collective team sports in the United States and elsewhere is that in the United States, they are dedicated to absolute managerial control. Every 13 seconds, the thing stops so that white bosses can tell black players or not what to do and how to behave for the next 5 seconds. Whereas if you look at rugby union, association football, etc., the bosses actually have minimal influence on what goes on the field of play because it's much more tactical and immediate than strategic. They stand on the sidelines and they scream and they get a lot of attention from the bourgeois media. But in fact, they have minimal influence because they can't be heard and frequently can't even be looked at given the frenetic pace of the game. So on the one hand, these are deeply collaborative enterprises always when they're teams. On the other, in these, you know, play-on sports, there is much less room for managerial, centralized managerial control than you get in the US sports model, which, like US capital in general, is as much about the desire for the exercise of power as it is about making money.
I mean, an interesting thing that's come up in sort of recent football coaching philosophy debates is the debate between what's called positional play and relationism. And positional play is the idea that you have set patterns of sort of like rational control. We want everyone in certain places to occupy space rationally. You know, like this is classic state planning, right? But an alternative approach coming out of Brazil is what's called relationism, which is about the relations and contingencies built into and emerging from how people relate rather than a plan. So you have those kind of things play out. Yeah, sorry.
But I do think also one of the points that you've said, and I should say, the opportunity to talk about communism, utopian, and sports is about the most fun I'm going to have on a Monday. So I really appreciate that. But what I find very interesting as well is that the kind of praxis of actually playing the sport is certainly really interesting in terms of a modeling of like this kind of managerialism. But within that framework, there's all types of kind of self-management that are the players have, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, you hear all about in American football, you know, quarterbacks doing audibles during the play, right? Certainly in basketball on the court, which is in basketball, probably in the US, the most kind of free-flowing game. That's popular, there's a huge amount of self-management. And yet, this doesn't translate very much into actual, within professional leagues, models or practices of self-management and community management of teams. And I do also think that's interesting because if you would kind of listen to about, you know, and this is back of the envelope, this is not empirical, but 30 to 35% of ESPN and sportscast, it's about how absolutely horrible teams and owners are as running teams, right? And how actually bad they are for communities in many ways. And yet that kind of notion of, well, maybe there's an alternative model just isn't even discussed. Even as, like, you know, they get a huge amount of commodified entertainment time over the discourses of, you know, how wonderful it is to have this kind of more self-managing player, right? And that's also very true if you look at the ways in which now that, you know, the players are supposed to be in a kind of Foucauldian way, much more self-disciplined. I mean, everyone talks about LeBron, for instance, LeBron James in basketball, for instance. Look at his workout regime and these types of things. So they're supposed to be more self-managing off the court, off the field of play, self-managing in the thing. You also then find that nobody thinks teams are run very well. And yet this kind of notion of an alternative model just isn't spoken about at all. And I'm really interested in why there's that disconnect, to be quite honest.
Well, you know, it makes me think of what Gramsci used to talk about sort of with popular consciousness, that it can occupy kind of two spheres simultaneously. That is you can both entertain very communist ideals and at the same time have very sort of conservative reactionary ideals, or often is the case, you have communist practices that then are made sense of through a very reactionary mindset. And I think that actually works pretty well for a lot of what sports activities, not just in terms of the playing of the game, but also the fans and how they engage in sort of this wonderful sort of communal aspect of identity and belonging and support and so on and so forth, and then get out in the parking lot and try to run each other over as a way, you know, in the effort to get home. And I bring this up because, you know, I think it actually segues a little bit into the kind of work that you all are doing in business schools, because Gramsci isn't just bringing this up as an idle observation. He's bringing it up to say, well, what is the role of the activist? Okay. And the role of the activist for him is to really draw upon those progressive communal ideas and sort of draw them out and show them to people and say, actually, you may identify this way, but your practice is doing this, and therefore bring the practice and the ideals together. And I'm always intrigued, and I've known Stephen for quite a long time, just met Peter, is, you know, that you guys are business schools. You know, the business school, I have nothing to do with it at NYU. They're over there. I have no idea who's over there. But, you know, it seems to be that a lot of my progressive comrades are actually in England, in the UK, in business schools, and actually in New York at Baruch, which is the business city university, has a very progressive Marxist accounting department. And so I'm just wondering how that works and how you work with students who are coming in thinking they're going to be the next business, you know, managers, or their parents have said, you really need to do this because they're first generation or what have you. And then what do you do with their expectations, and what do you do with the framework?
So
you're given.
I wonder if, Stephen, maybe I could give a little bit of context to that. And then you might want to also speak a little bit to your experience with this, because I think you're very much right. I mean, it's really interesting that some of the most radical spaces, certainly in the UK and oftentimes across Europe, are within management or business schools. Right. And that's something that I think has happened, like many, many kind of, I would say, progressive projects, both intentionally and also a little serendipitously. So I think the short answer to this is that it was an interesting combination of a reduction in investment of funds in the social sciences and humanities on the one hand, and a growing realization that management and organization were fundamental objects of study for social transformation. And this created, I think, a very interesting dynamic where you started to get, I don't want to say counterpower even, right? But certainly very strong pockets and some movable pockets and some disciplinary work around critical management studies, organization studies, that was around thinking through the implications of management and managerialism and the radical possibilities of organization. I think going a little backwards, it was somewhat recapturing this idea that I think to a certain extent maybe had been lost in the 1980s and 1990s, in which, you know, a lot of the focus on radicalism was this kind of post-Marxist, and I understand it, idea of critique and this type of activism, as you said, of, you know, how do we critique neoliberalism? And the notion of actually the nuts and bolts and everyday what it would mean to actually create and run a socialist society and economy and organization, that had kind of, I think, been put at least in Europe and the UK and my experience in the US on the back burner because it seems so far off, right? And so I do think that what you've seen now increasingly over the last 10 years is also the movement within this kind of space to begin thinking about, okay, well, we know the issues of capitalist managerialism. What is the function of management? What is the function of marketing? What is the function of organization, right, for alternative forms of societies and economy on a day-to-day level, in terms of design, and in terms of the reproduction? And that has been, for me, something that has kept me in a business school because it's incredibly exciting, right? Because you do, I mean, it's when you say you're on the cutting edge, but you feel very much that, you know, you're not just repeating past debates or whatever, but that you really can add something new, especially because a lot of the ways in which we're now discussing this takes into ideas things like social reproduction, which largely hadn't been discussed. I would say, you know, after the Second International in that kind of deep sense, right? It takes into ideas of new technologies and how you can update kind of past ideas like cybernetics into something more democratic, but still quite data-driven. I mean, so in a sense, it feels not just critique, but also that you're really doing something exciting in that sense. Because at the end of the day, a key question is, how do you manage a more liberated society freed from the notion of the capitalist manageable subject? And that's kind of a central question for any revolutionary initiative. So I think that's the first part. Before going to second to actual students, I thought maybe, Stephen, if you wanted to maybe add or not add to that, because I also gave a very romantic view, and we can talk later about, I think, the praxis and the limitations and difficulties of this as well. But I did want to give a bit of a utopian notion based on this, of why business schools have emerged as these types of exciting spaces.
Yeah, if I could jump in on that, I would say that one of the things I had to learn rather quickly when I was sort of teaching at business school is I had first assumed that I was going to be encountering students who were there from some sort of like deep-seated love of wanting to be a business person or aspiring to be a certain kind of entrepreneurial subject. Yeah. And I quickly discovered, and this is not a surprise, over the past 15, 20 years, that you have a situation where you have people's sort of livelihoods are becoming much more precarious and uncertain, right? So you have parents who are saying, and for Essex for years and years, we had a lot of students who were first-time university students. So their parents were like, you know, saying, okay, go over here, go study business. It's something which will give you sort of, you know, it's safe, right? So your students who come into business schools, not because of a deep love of business itself or even a desire to really study business, as much as they what they're doing is they want the idea about their livelihood or their life path will not be crap. And that's part of sort of meeting people where they're at is realizing that where they're coming from is that. Secondly, in terms of the context of shifting the business school curriculum, I think is perhaps somewhat easier because I'm going to say that as compared to other, let's say, disciplines, there's not a sort of like a great love for the canon or the history. Like no one's going to start crying about like, you have, you know, said mean things about Talcott Parsons, right? And when you don't have that historical baggage that you feel beholden to, it becomes easier to sort of shift a discussion because there's not that.
And just to pick up on the canon part, I think from this curriculum, but also research side, the lack of a kind of discipline field in business, and certainly like I'm a political economist, right? So I don't come from this background. And I was very surprised because obviously when I was doing my PhD in the government department here at Essex, gosh, I'm very old, but we would spend so much of our time having discussion between the discourse analysis who were drawing on Gramsci and Laclau, for instance, in very particular, and Lacan versus the positivist versus the game theorist. And there wasn't it was almost as if there was this kind of very repetitive and kind of disciplinary perpetual cycle of this, right? That you got very trapped in. And some of it was quite exciting. But for the most part, everyone had, I would say, their kind of tribal affiliations. And then when you went to teach, your curriculum was very much things. I remember when I first joined a business school, they were pretty much, in a certain sense, just, I said, well, what you want me to teach business ethics? And I'll admit, it was a very incentivized, alienated thing of saying, okay, there's a job here. And they were saying, yeah, teach whatever you want. And I'm like, really? And I'm sure you've had that experience too, Stephen, where if you're teaching in a politics department or a philosophy department or economics department or sociology, kind of places I'd probably be more mapped out on, if I'm being honest. I've had in those situations a much more constrained, though still quite important, kind of thing. This is what you have to teach. Whereas in business schools, it's actually we kind of it's kind of like an empty signifier hegemony, right? We get to fill a lot of that signifier within certain bounds, obviously, but it's much more shifting. I don't know, Stephen, did you also have that experience in a certain sense?
Yeah, when I first started working here, my first task was to teach marketing. So I decided marketing was actually a doorknob. In retrospect, that was probably a bad idea. Not because it was a bad idea to talk about a doorknob, but because it actually made it harder to get to the students because they found it harder to relate to that. But just thinking about that, I remember when I was starting my PhD, I asked my advisor, Martin Parker, what's critical management studies? And his response was, well, I don't know, Stephen. What do you want it to be? Make it that. Now, this was a good answer because obviously he was lying. He knew exactly what it meant, but he could have just like told me exactly, okay, here are the books, here's what you read, here's what you do. But by basically faking I don't know, he was almost like inviting you to say, well, use as a space to make other things. And I think that's a more intellectually productive move to make is that sort of like almost deliberate unknowing.
And I would say that, before getting to the students, the interesting aspect is that I think there's oftentimes tensions between in critical management studies, the degree that we should be in critique and the degree we should be prefigurative. And certainly, I would say that our group has probably gone, for a whole range of reasons, much more in the kind of latter part of saying that I think we know the problems of management and we know a lot of the problems of business and these types of things. What we have much less notions are is the actual kind of emancipatory and revolutionary possibilities of our current conditions, right? What would an alternative society look like? What are existing ideas, like you've kind of said, Steve, earlier about it's great to I have utopian ideas, but how do we backtrack and create pathways towards that, et cetera. And in a certain sense, I would also share, and the reason I bring that up is that ironically, it's very much in line with at least the quote unquote branding of current UK and European universities, which are very much around social value and inclusion and how do you address grand challenges. So in a way, we're also quite fortunate because we're not doing anything different than what they're asking us. They're saying, how do you come up with a value-based, way to address climate change? Well, here are three different degrowth models that you can use, right? And also, I then think that goes to students. Students, business school students in general, and of course, you don't want to stereotype anything, but they're not the kind of stereotype that many people might have, which is kind of like 1980s Wall Street comes in a business suit type of things. I want to put aside the commodification of students for a second, which is about universities across the world becoming education factories, because that's its own, I think, problem. But I would say that business students have a kind of utopian notion already inbuilt. And that's either I'm going to become, as you've said, and I think more mainstream things, the next CEO or whatever. I mean, that's completely utopian, right? Or it's I'm going to use ideas like entrepreneurship to make a difference in the world. And where you do begin to see some really interesting abilities to create dialectical movements for real change is that they do see that there's less and less jobs in corporations. There's less and less opportunities for traditional SMEs, right? And it's not things to say that the cooperative sector, for instance, is one of the largest, right, sectors that is growing. Social enterprises, local authorities that are doing really interesting work. And that these are all things that if you can learn the skills, how to turn and translate, for instance, again, let's say, you know, anarcho-socialist degrowth policies into really viable KPIs, that you can get a job in these and make a difference.
Well, I just hop in for a second there, Peter, just to clarify a couple of acronyms you used.
Oh, yeah.
SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, KPIs, key penile indicators.
Yeah, I mean, and I would say, because I want to bring Stephen in, I mean, one of the really interesting things that I think Stephen has done is really taken to creative industries and actually, you know, created spaces there for students. And they're, I mean, Stephen, you can speak to this, but they're incredibly interested in it, right?
Most of the time. I mean, what I wanted to turn on that is I wanted to say, for a number of years, I was teaching business ethics, and we spent a lot of time sort of introducing and examining various corporate social responsibility programs, then sort of taking them apart. And I thought that was the way to do it. And at a certain point, I realized actually there was a key flaw, and that we'd end up with students at the end would say, yeah, but like we realized that all of these CSR programs are like basically marketing and they're self-serving and they're basically like, you know, there's like window dressing and there's no actual ethics. So I ended up with the students who became more and more cynical about any organizational practice actually not being crap. And so mm-hmm. that was actually not what the intent was. It's just this way it ended up. So I think in terms of the relationship between, let's say, critique and alternative forms, the way I like to think of it is a bit like the way the situationists talk about the relationship to art, which is you both have to simultaneously overcome and elaborate an art practice. So it's not, so any alternative, which is just like, let's say, given by itself, it can easily become the new marketing strategy, the new sort of like, you know, work plan. And any critique, which is just by itself, is also kind of pointless. So it's how you do both things at the same time, which is tricky, but that's what I think is the overall goal. And right. also thinking about when we talk to students who keep talking about how they want to start their own businesses, I realize the reason they're saying that is because what they're essentially saying is, I would like to not have a boss. I don't want to be ordered around. And when you put it that way, I go, oh, okay, I understand that, definitely.
You know, I teach in an interdisciplinary school. And so we have a lot of students and increasingly more students in the past decade who come in and say, I want to do business and that and can be poetry, it can be dance, it can be, you know, social justice work and so on and so forth. And a lot of my colleagues sort of roll their eyes at the business part and get very excited about the and part. But as of late, I've gotten very interested in that business part for reasons that I think resonate with what I'm hearing from you, which is the students are practical minded. And by practical minded is that they want to put these ideas into practice. And the liberal arts are horrible at doing this. We really actually are very bad about giving them pathways from the theories that we kind of expound upon in our classroom to how you can actually put this into use. And so I get very excited by the business students in a way because they demand like, well, how are we going to use Adorno? Is this useful for us? So I think that that's something that's a really exciting part because it moves us away from what I think is a sterile culture of critique in the in the academy and towards this sort of more prefigurative model of construction, which I think is great. But I also wanted to kind of flip this on its head just a little bit and say, you know, instead of meeting business students and, you know, kind of explaining how Adorno might be useful. One of the things that I do outside of the academy is I train activists, right? And we actually bring business ideas to them. So we will do whole trainings where we talk about cost-benefit analysis and stages of engagement models and even the four Ps and how activists can actually learn from marketers to do more successful activism. And our kind of line is always like, you know, these people are really smart and they are interested in not just raising awareness, but they're interested in behavioral change. They don't care if you think smoking is a good idea. They want you to go out and buy a pack of cigarettes, right? Yep. And as activists, we don't want to create radical ideas. We want people with radical ideas to create radical actions, right? And so I've gotten very interested in the limits, possibilities and limits of how we can actually use business tools in the activist space. And I know my wife, who teaches in the media, culture, and communications department here, what they've kind of allowed her a space to do is take all these students who really want to do advertising, right? That's there. They came, they want to do advertising. She says, okay, great, advertising. How can we use these tools for social change? And she's created this whole sort of series of courses for Social Impact Studio, where they're doing marketing. She comes out of an advertising background, right? But they're thinking about it in terms of the recycling program for the sanitation department, like really practical sort of things that we need to do if we're going to create a new society is how do you get people to recycle? But using these marketing things, but there is a limit too. And I think you know, if you guys have fallen into that as well, whether you actually sometimes teach business practices as a way to bring in a new world and what the limits might be.
So if I can just respond, I think what you're talking about is very much aligned with a lot of what we do, both within or hopefully within our programs increasingly, but also outside of it with the kind of organizations and communities and governments that we work with. And one of the things I would say, kind of putting that almost on its head, is that it's very interesting when we work with cooperatives or activists and things. And one of the first things that you kind of bring with them that they talk about, but then they don't actually do analysis of, is burnout and labor intensification. Mm-hmm. And that's because for them, there becomes a kind of ways in which politics is a form of, I would actually say in a very kind of effective way, masochistic investment, right? And so one of the key parts about this is like on a very material level of reproduction, right? What kinds of things are you putting in place, right, to make your ideas not only more accessible to, you know, people for understanding and to make action out of them, but also so that you're not working so hard, so that you can get more people involved and the work involved in it isn't so intense, so that the opportunity cost for people to engage with this, both as activists, but also just consumers and everyday users, is less, right? How do you do that? And I think that's where a lot of the kinds of management tool, traditional management tools, but also new ones become much more effective. And I would say that it's exactly those types of questions that if we want to turn, you know, counter hegemonic spaces into actually counter forms of counter power, right, you really need to do. I would say for me, some of the limits of that, though, within a business school is, you know, something probably that doesn't necessarily just have to do with being a business school, but when you're dealing with these neoliberal spaces, you're constantly engaged in a process of kind of covering up, right? In which always trying to do more with less, always trying to find ways to deal with what is essentially, you know, if neoliberalism started with the shock doctrine, it's now perpetuated through crisis management cultures, right? So in this sense, I actually think that these types of questions become more difficult in the sense that everywhere you look, including within universities, you're kind of on an everyday basis dealing with the complete stagnation and failure of the system, and you have to kind of cover it and make it better. But I think the point that you're saying about how can we actually make kind of radical, even revolutionary things, and for people who are involved in these activities, something that is quite frankly more emancipatory through management and through management tools. For me, again, I'm biased, but I think it's a crucial question. And it's something that we try to provide the skills for and epistemologies for. I don't know. I mean, as one person who actually runs, I don't know if it's a business team, but actually runs an organization and who's incredibly good at organizing administration. What I mean, how do you feel about this, man?
I mean, again, I think I look at things very practically, which is at the level of marketing, I think that there are a lot of great tools that capitalism has created in order to reach people's, hearts and minds. And there's a limit to its adaptation too. You always have to remember that these things were created to get people to buy stuff, not create revolution. In terms of management, that's a really interesting question, which is like, how do we manage the Center for Artistic Activism? I mean, it's now we have $1 million a year budget, which is just astounding. And we have really, really competent executive director now and a really, really competent financial person. And they make decisions which are great, but they're so foreign to me. And I think that isn't about their lack, it's about my lack, which is that I, even as we're trying to create these institutions, which is a proto-institution to create a larger world that has to be managed in some way, I was kind of resistant to management. It was always just like, well, you know what? We're having a good time. As long as we can meet the bills at the end of the week, that's fine, and so on and so forth. You know, really been educated by these people running the Center for Artistic Activism at the management level of like, no, you can't do that. That just actually screws over other people. And that means that we can't actually do the kind of work that we want to do. We really have to think in terms of managing people. So, you know, again, it's an interesting the field that you both are in, which is like, well, how can we impress upon activists, young activists and old activists, that if you're going to run an organization and if you're going to run a larger world, how do you actually do that? How do you manage people? It can't just be through charisma. It
No,
can't
definitely.
just be through, hey man, it's all going to work out. Human nature's good. We've just been corrupted by capitalism. We really have to think about a science of management and a liberatory science of management. And so when you are thinking this through, how do you think about that in two ways? One is, how do you think about it within the given world of today? We have a 501c3. It is a New York State corporation. It has to follow certain rules. So that's today. Also, in the new world to become, how do you actually think about managing? So it's kind of the transition between how do you create a radical space within the reactionary world today? But then when we actually transfer over to the radical new world, how are we going to manage it? And I'll just end with one more thing. This was David Harvey, my great David Harvey story. So I was a kind of a firebrand anarchist, and I was taking a seminar with David Harvey, and he was being, the usual David Harvey, wonderful, generous, and so on and so forth. And at a certain point, he said to me, "Steve, that's a really, really wonderful ideas that you have there, but how are you going to manage the sewage system?" And I was like, "Shit, right? How am I going to manage the sewage system with my anarchist principles, right?" And now I thought about it and I realized there is an answer to that, right? But I thought that what he was calling out was a really great thing, which is that until you can run a sewer system for a city of a couple million people, and figure that through, we really don't want you running cities because they're going to stink pretty badly.
So I definitely have, for all the things you said, I mean, it's stuff that I think about every day, and I have some questions, but like, I wonder, Stephen Shakaitis, like, also, you might want to come in because I'd be interested in your journey around minor compositions, for instance. And the ways in which you've kind of been part of, but also, I mean, I just if you want to share like the ways in which management as both a kind of as Stephen said, an unavoidable thing, but also as a kind of praxis for you to kind of think about feasibility and things like this. I mean, one thing I will share is that when Stephen and I run the center, it's amazing because you can tell that he runs an organization or that he's part of it because the first thing he always asks is like, what's our cost codes? What's our budget? Do we have a cost code? With it, and in a way, I used to think, I'll just share this, is that it's a very nice way in practice of, I would say, it might sound boring at first, but when you think about the feasibility and logistics immediately, it actually both empowers you to think, oh, we can do this, right? Because we're talking about doing this. But also like, oh, what do we need to do this and what can we do otherwise? But I want Stephen, I wonder if you wanted to maybe talk a little bit about just your experience like in this, because you do run an organization, essentially.
Well, the interesting thing is, and maybe this is like the anti-sewer example, is there are certain practices that you always want to think about how you scale up and how you expand in order to run on a bigger scale. And there's some where you almost deliberately decide to keep it a certain scale for a reason. So like the joke we have at Autonomedia is if the banks are too big to fail, we're too small to fail. So there's a certain kind of freedom that can be kept by keeping at a certain scale where you manage to avoid those kind of scaling questions. Now, I'm not saying that you should always avoid them, because obviously they're very important, and Comrade Harvey asked the right question there. But like, not everything has to grow in order to be successful. So I guess it's almost a question of what are the practices and organizing practices that are most suited and most resonant with the scale you're intending to operate at. And what are you trying to accomplish, and how do you suit your organizing in order to fit that, rather than thinking any particular organization model should be glued onto any practices being the inherently correct one. And I think that's one of the sort of the biggest sort of, let's say, mistakes made in a lot of management education is working for this idea that there is always is a one correct method. Like, no, there's many correct methods depending on which scale and which situation.
Go ahead. Sorry about that, brother.
So publishing, I mean, Autonomedia and the input I run Minor Compositions has stuck to a sort of more small informal model, not because it's the best model per se, but because it works for what we're trying to do right now.
Mm-hmm. Could I just pop in for a quick second? People mentioned 501c3s. This refers to a code in the US tax legislation, and it's for what are set up as not-for-profit entities that do not embark on political activity, by which is meant capital P political activity, i.e. militating for a particular public policy, specifically through the voting process. So you jeopardize your status if you are an organization nominated as this, if you say vote Republican, which should in fact jeopardize your status in every conceivable sense also. Sorry to jump in. Just only a quarter of our listeners are based in the United States, although that is the plurality of listeners.
Yeah. Thank you, Toby. I think we lost Peter for a second. So I'm going to jump in, just ask Stephen.
Go ahead, please.
And then just again, going back to this notion of building now and building for the future. Like, and how do you, both of you, navigate both the needs of your students now, but also to help them understand the world of today, yet also imagine models of management for a world of tomorrow?
I think it's a good question. It's something that we work on a lot. And I think one of the aspects, like going back to the sewage question, because it actually encapsulates this, right? Is that there's kind of three levels that this exists. On the first, and it's one that I think, you know, I wish, you know, my revolutionary comrades would take more seriously often, is the ways in which it's actually a radical democratic question. Like, if you don't have an answer for this, right, then you shouldn't be getting mass support, right? But it is also about, that's the point about which you start thinking about alternatives from a point of view of utopian to logistics. And logistics is where the revolution's at, right? Like, how do you actually reproduce the society that you want? And that's actually, ironically, then, the creative space in a very imminent way in which you can get yourself and students to think in more utopian. Like, so how would you do this? Let's scenario plan this out. What are there? And I think that's like a project that I'm working on now is a book project looking at the movement from a very Enlightenment notion around this ontological question of the conditions of possibility to what I think is a more emancipatory praxis things of what are your possibilities of the condition of your conditions. Now, from that basis with students, I think we have been very fortunate in the sense that they're kind of one and the same. Because on the one hand, you are trying to get them to think about, you know, What skills do you need to enter this workforce, for instance? And you have to be very honest with that as part of a business school because that's what they want, et cetera. But you're trying to say, how do these link to more utopian or more prefigurative, more radical ideas? So an example is democratic decision-making in sociocracy, right? That is a model that can be used for actually creating a decentralized structure for decision-making that is quite democratic. Right. But it's also something that if they have, they can use this for the benefit of any organization of which they're part. I think one of the aspects that's been very interesting, and I wrote a blog about it for our university because our VC is now outgoing. They didn't take it, understand, but essentially about all the evidence shows you should not have executives. So why do we continue to have a VC? Why do we have an executive? Even if you're Microsoft or any organization. You don't need a CEO, and CEOs are largely a drain on, even in the most capitalist sense. So, what would be a more value-based organizational design that you can? I would say, though, that one thing that we try to work with students, and we're very fortunate because, for instance, we have one of our group members is Rodrigo Nunes, who's just written a, not just written, but he's written a fantastic book, Neither Vertical Nor Horizontal. Which, and I think, to, without, you obviously can't do justice to a book like this in 2 minutes, but I think very nicely talks about how you can be opportunistic with various types of organizational forms without being an opportunist, right? And there are places in which hierarchy can be, or more vertical forms of organization can be most appropriate, right? In a revolutionary project or initiative or radical change. And being able to get students, like if you're looking at the sewage problem, to think in this kind of organization mindset, like what are the social political conditions that are impacting this? What are the economic conditions? What are the ecological conditions? And how do you see the various possibilities that arise from them? And then how do you make discernments about what are the things that are the best fit is actually something that is fundamental to an emancipatory form of management. So I don't, that was maybe a long answer, but that's largely, I think, what a radical management perspective attempts to do. And I think to what Stephen said, like also understanding scales and understanding you don't need global solutions, you need local solutions, right? These are the types of things. And I would finally say that I think, you've kind of talked about in your book, Stephen, but also like, I mean, so much of what is quote unquote rational reality is just made up spectacle for these students, right? They don't, I mean, most of the students, and you don't want to be Asian, but they're between the ages of 18 and 25 or 18 and 30. Their entire upbringing is in an economy that's based on fictional value, right? Made up money, right? So their entire life is essentially fiction. And valuable fiction. So, in a certain sense, there's a way in which they're way more comfortable, right, thinking about the practicalities of fictionality and spectacle than I think. I mean, I'm telling how old I am, where, growing up in the 90s, there was still some notion that there was some relationship between material production and capitalist value. That was importantly, hard to deprogram, but you don't really need to deprogram it for these students because their entire economy and life and culture is based on speculative things, if that makes sense. Like,
The thing I wanted to jump in on there on is the book that I've been trying to finish. I've been behind years on is I'm trying to finish a book with my friend Joanna Fiegel called The Waiting for Dream Work, and which is mainly based off of conversations with sort of small scale creatives, people working in fashion and media and various creative industries in East London. And the dynamic there about when people are so invested in their practice as makers, designers, creatives, that they don't want to talk about the organizing practices or the business aspects because they don't want that to deal with that at all. And so what we're looking at is sort of, well, the complications that it creates, where you want to be involved in invested in your creative practice, but you don't want to talk about what actually makes it possible. And so if the move I was trying to make before was trying to unpack the creative potentials of various practices, this is almost like the flip side of saying, it's almost like the flip side of what you were saying earlier about Gramsci, Steve, about like what your practice buys you into, where you don't want to talk about what's underneath it and what supports it. And trying to get them to think, well, okay, I get why you want to be doing this. I get why you want to be passionately involved in your thing. Who doesn't? But if you want to keep doing this, there needs to be an underlying structure that supports it. And the way you're approaching it as atomized individuals does not lead to that. So what would be the conditions necessary for you to have that autonomy, to have that self-determination?
I
That's
mean,
brilliant.
I wonder, Steve, if I could ask you a question coming from, because
We'll have to wonder what that question was. I can imagine what that question
well,
was.
can I, can, oh, sorry, Steve, go ahead.
Nope, Peter. You cut out.
You're still silent. You've been silenced by the capitalist machine, old boy. We need you to
Yes,
break out of.
is that better? Sorry, I don't know what's going, but like one of the things that you mentioned earlier is that when you went to Glasgow, you could see that there was still a very kind of at least latent understanding of social value, etc. And one of the points that I'm very interested in the US is that there is this history for sure, right? But when I have to be honest, and again, coming from the US but now living in the UK for over 20 years, I would say the fantasy of employability is so ingrained and deep, right? I mean, and that idea of social value, that idea of really thinking about like you could join a cooperative, right? I mean, in the US, even I would say among those who I think are very, very committed, radicals or have this things, but just on every day, I mean, the level about which you have a kind of financially disciplined populace that knows how to write a CV is extremely either good at getting a job or knowing how to say that they don't get a job so they can get very minimum welfare benefits. I mean, and I'm wondering how you deal with students in terms of that, because it seems like at least Stephen and I often, even though we have a lot of international students, we're able to draw on a certain tradition that hasn't completely died that I don't see in the US. But then I haven't been there as a resident for 20 years or nor taught there. So maybe I'm completely wrong on that.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think that the success of neoliberalism in the United States is really to remove the sense that there's any alternative. You know, it's the Margaret Thatcher, there is no alternative. Well, it actually worked out quite well for the neoliberalists here because the students just don't have a capacity to imagine anything out of max outside of maximizing their value, commodifying themselves so that they can actually get a job. And I keep asking myself, you know, I'm even older than you. I went to university in the 1980s. I didn't really think about myself as employable at all. Because at some level, I had this idea and ideal that somehow, some way, things would open, there would be spaces and places for me to inhabit. There very well might be those spaces and places today, but students don't believe that there are. And so it really is about trying to make, you know, the fear of precarity is just palpable amongst the students. And so the idea is, how do you market yourself? How do you sort of separate yourself, distinguish yourself, give yourself a unique selling proposition so you can actually enter into the market? And a lot of these students are entering into the market with massive amounts of debt. And this is a big difference between
Yes.
Europe and the United States, is that they have to worry about healthcare. They have to worry about the educational debt, that there is a reality to that precarity that those students have that I don't feel when I visit my friends, say in Denmark or in Scotland or whatever. There's just a kind of a level of anxiety which isn't there, which allows for an amazing amount of experimentation.
Yeah, well, but then I would say that I wonder, because you mentioned New York earlier, but like, so right now, one of the big fears in the UK, and certainly is that what you're going to have against this kind of far right is a kind of technocratic center right response, and certainly the Labour Party. is a party under Starmer, Keir Starmer in the UK, that seems to embody that. But what becomes very interesting is that that actually might be the most radical thing possible if we play our cards right, because of precarity in Europe, in the UK, for sure, right? Right wing, left wing, whatever. I mean, there's no money, right, for local communities and cities. They have no money. So all of a sudden, 5 years ago, if you would come up with mutual aid or cooperativism or community wealth building, they would say, what are you talking about? We just want developer money. Now, whether it's right wing or left wing, you cannot go into this meeting without a social value framework. You cannot go in without talking about local procurement practices. And it's completely based on the structural contradictions of neoliberalism and precarity themselves, because at a level of collective governance at these places, they are completely precarious and they have no money, right? So they need to do everything they can for a new model. And what one of the reasons that, like, I mean, if we're speaking in terms of class dynamics, I'm very interested in the precarious class and how it's recomposing class struggle, in the sense that you're actually being able in a business school over here to potentially say, okay, well, all of these people at the municipal level, they need new solutions and they want them because they don't have money and they're precarious, right? So if that's the case, we're going to be the ones who actually can be the new technicians, right? We can be the long march through institutions in which we actually, you know, because of precarity, step in and say, these are more resilient models. Now, what I have found in the US through my things is that even amidst all this, I mean, you have some cases like Cleveland, for instance, that does like the Evergreen Cooperatives and things, but like I've been extraordinarily interested that, you know, I see these things, and my family is from the Baltimore area, but my mother's family is from West Virginia. And one of the interesting aspects, I remember watching this video, they were saying, well, we need to reach out to these communities, quote unquote, left behind from the left. And the answer was, and hopefully get Google to come here. And it's like, no, like there's other solutions that you can have that doesn't. So it seems to me, if I can share, is that over here, very much under the surface, precarity has actually allowed for past ideas that would have seemed radical to now just seem not only reasonable, but needed. Whereas I'm not sure why, but in the US, I mean, New York is calling out for basic community wealth building strategies.
Yeah.
And it's gone, and it's so, like you said, it's so precarious now in New York at every level, right? And it's gone in a total other direction. It seems like they're even less open to these ideas. Yeah. So I'm kind of trying to figure out why that's the case in the US and what it would mean then for creating a new generation of actual kind of socialist technocrats, if you will.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, it's a very good question. There's a couple of ways to think about it. One is the Cleveland model, which is actually this sort of development is not going to happen in a place like New York City or Los Angeles or even San Francisco. It's going to happen in Cleveland. It's going to happen in Baltimore. It's going to be happening in places which are actually more precarious and therefore have to be more scrappy and try to figure out how to create sort of, you know, as you point out, sort of cooperative models, because they've got nothing else. I think part of the problem in places like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, the major areas, is still the fantasy, which we were talking about before, that I'm going to be the entrepreneur. I'm going to be the exception. I'm going to be the one that rises to the top, which in a place like Cleveland, if you were going to rise to the top, you would have left for New York already, right? And it's to a certain extent, same thing is true in Glasgow, okay? Which is if you were going to rise to the top, you would have left to London already. And so these kind of smaller places, smaller spaces might be actually the real epicenters. The New Deal, for example, in the United States, people forget that it was really forged way before the national government, in places like Troy, New York, in Wisconsin, and so on and forth. That these were experiments that people were able to find new models, for running a society and running an economy that then FDR was able to tap into in creating the New Deal. So that's one space place. The other thing is we might just be behind y'all, which is that, you know, we're in that moment of precarity, but we don't have that moment of, oh, there could be something else. It's still kind of, I've got to get mine. I've got to get my little piece of it. As people realize they're not going to get their piece of it, we might get that sort of turning that it seems like you're seeing in the UK?
No, I think that's a really interesting point. And I'm also wondering, Stephen Shikaitis, like some of the work that you've seen, I mean, because you kind of have some experience with, like, especially in Europe, like on a personal level, but also sort of like, you know, different communes, different artistic communities, different experiments and these types of things. I mean, what do you think that those kinds of initiatives that I think are becoming more relevant and popular? In fact, what was it like? My wife's from Italy, and I didn't even know Stephen and I were in the same city without knowing, because I was visiting my in-laws, and it was a cheese-making commune, right? An artistic. What were you visiting in Lecce? I forget.
I was staying at, there were some artists who had been together to buy a sort of, basically it was a country house, and they were using it as a sort of like art space retreat center.
Mm. So I'm wondering if maybe you wanted to come in a little bit, because it is something, as we're teaching about the social economy and our new pathways, about that relationship between, you know, creating, as you said, Stephen, early, like when you were a student in the 80s, like what would be those spaces that are kind of spaces for radicalism, with kind of, can we create more mainstream, large scale kinds of models for, you know, cities like Glasgow or Cleveland to actually use to move towards a socialist economy?
Well, I mean, to give one example of a group that I was working with maybe a year ago or so, was a group from Chicago called Catalytic Sound. And they're a bunch of musicians performing mainly in, let's say, free jazz, experimental, improvised noise music, right? And they band together to sort of distribute, organize the distribution and sale of their records, because it's, you know, hard to do all that stuff as individual artists, right? But then they also set up their own collective streaming service.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was quite interesting, where they were trying to figure out sort of like how their individualized artistic practices could be banded together and deal with sort of a larger scale platform question. But the thing that was interesting about it was that their plan was it also to say, okay, how can we make this bigger and bigger and bigger? But was okay, what is the scale for this? And then how could this create a model that can be adopted by other people, rather than just trying to constantly increase the size of one particular thing? And I thought that was quite interesting, because I think that's a problem that a lot of sort of creatives have in terms of dealing with sort of, well, particularly the name of the platform economy now, where they're sort of subject to that logic. So how do you find a way to create a sort of collective logic, a social logic, which can interface with that sort of the platform economy without becoming totally sort of subsumed by it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's that point as well, is about adaptability and customization is really interesting. Like we talked about earlier, like the local revolution, right? In the sense that I think that people are moving away from one size fits all in general, and creating things that are modular and adaptable so that people can kind of draw on them, use them, see what works for them, is kind of the way forward. And I think it is about creating those types of networks and experiments that say, okay, well, this worked for us, and maybe it works in Glasgow, but it wouldn't work directly in Cleveland, but it's a model that we could draw upon and make our own. And then, you know, I think the aspect that I would like to see, and that we're trying to begin teaching in the business school, is about how do you start thinking about these from just a basic organization level or governance level to a mode of production level, right? So, I mean, when you're looking at something like platforms and streaming, how do you kind of say, okay, but who's also producing this, right? What are things? And that's a process of kind of mapping that I think that, because neoliberalism is often very firm-based, right? We just need a huge amount of work over the next 5 to 10 years to begin being more, if you will, mode-based, right? From production to consumption to use.
So the thing I think we're doing, and this is going to be a weird way, but I want to bring in, is I was thinking recently about Toby's book, Blow Up the Humanities, right? Mm-hmm. Where he starts with sort of, okay, I'm going to paraphrase your argument here. Toby, tell me if I got it wrong, right? So if humanities one is the more sort of, let's say, the elitist version of the humanities, right? The sort of like very high foot abstract version of the humanities. Humanities two is kind of like more like humanities as like vo-tech training, right? And then you end up with humanities, a third mode of the humanities, which is basically like a cultural studies mode of engaged critical practice, where you do things and then reflect through the doing. Roughly? Badly.
A, I think you've read it more recently than I have. B, I think you understood it better than I did. And C, here's a quotation that I think I made up. It comes from a former Australian swimmer named Lisa Curry, who, when asked about the publication of her fifth autobiography, said, "I've written more books than I've read." So, no, in all seriousness, that is right. I was thinking about the United States because that was the system that I knew best. And I was thinking about the fact that the Ivy Leagues and fancy, really fancy state schools like Berkeley and rich private schools like, say, Tulane or Rice or USC, or to give it its technical name, University of Spoilt Children, that are not in the Ivies, Duke, NYU, as Stanley Aronowitz called it, a public university in the private service, reversing the description on its letterhead of a private university in the public service. What these things do is to reproduce the ruling class very effectively in terms of creating networks of subjectivity that can apply throughout the rest of life. And they do so by privileging, in part, the aesthetic self.
Right.
The aesthetic self as the subject post-industrial revolution. This is slightly more highfalutin than I made it in the book, because I was trying to ferment revolution, which I failed in, but never met last. The idea that the industrial revolution split subjectivity. It split subjectivity in terms of there being an inevitable division between word and meaning, that had in a sense always been there, but also between self and meaning and collectivity because of the division of labor, right? So they managed to provide a way out of that through aesthetics, where you will be able to uncover your split subject and learn to embrace it and love it and not necessarily resist it. Because these were powerful and wealthy institutions, they created vast networks that spread across the United States of people with degrees, especially in literary studies, with PhDs, who became professors in Research One schools, Research Two schools, you know, pure undergrad, etc. The problem is that, and I'm about to stop, because Stephen gave a perfect summary of the book that's shorter than what I'm now saying. The problem was that there was an outreach from the domain of speech and mass communication, which in the United States, conversely to the heritage of the Ivies, emerged in the so-called spine of the country as means of providing a form of communication in the English language for white immigrant groups from Europe in the last part of the 19th century and the first part of the 20th century, part of the reform era. And that project of creating a proletarian and farming workforce that could communicate with English as the lingua franca took hold in the form of disciplines like speech communication, rhetoric, and so on, but then branched out once radio arrived in Wisconsin in the early 20s to produce mass communication dedicated on the one hand to selling stuff and on the other hand to stopping people from becoming communists or fascists. What's happened is that that latter tradition has moved out from being a Midwestern and Southern obsession in the United States to being national and to being of greater interest to students than literature or history, such that all these people who have not been part of the ruling class reproduced through the Ivies, but have been the fraction of it that does PhDs there, end up roaming around the country having a really hard time because they've been displaced in the traditional citizenship and labor preparation task of the humanities by these other more vocational areas.
I mean, one of the things that, to build on that, because it's a great book and it's also a very nice description, is how then this has somewhat evolved over the last 15 years with the uptake in everyday life of certain traditional humanities skills. So one of the aspects that I've been very interested from a kind of political economy perspective, but then also within a business school, is students now are fantastic at self-archiving, right? So they're incredible at like this kind of historical archiving of themselves and things. I mean, it's amazing to know and understand how they are less interested in kind of mass communication, but they are very interested in how do I present myself based on the various texts that exist of me to the world, to different people. And you see in their everyday life, this move from kind of mass communication that I think you're very right about that became hegemonic and kind of displaced a kind of humanity, a particular type of humanity scholar and studies, to what I would call a more personalized and customized communication. And this is a kind of highfalutin way of saying they're really good at creating more than one Facebook account. They're really good at creating and self-censoring their Twitter. They're fantastic at it. But then and this is the more radical question for me to a certain extent, not, you know, but like when you ask them to use that as a point of how do we take these skills and use these then to, first of all, more better understand critically an organization, so just basic research, or to actually start thinking about how you would use this for kind of social impact, creating alternatives, et cetera. Like, I don't know if it's because the pedagogy hasn't caught up. Maybe, like, I'm just not a very good teacher. But, like, that transition is hard, right? That idea of, like, how would you actually use archiving, for instance? How would you actually take advantage of the fact that you're really already good at moving from the mass communication epistemologies of the 1920s, or sorry, the 20th century, to the kind of, you know, personalization kind of mentalities of the 21st century? That process of actually, you know, which is a very kind of, I just like, I would say, existing humanity skill, right? It's very hard to get them to actually radicalize that in their everyday practice in life, right? Even while, like, they'll say, I don't know how to do it. But meanwhile, why they're saying that they're on their phone, literally, you know, archiving other people, looking up things very quickly, you know, creating their own profiles. And so that bridge, I've really been trying to think about how we fill that gap. And I don't know maybe if anyone else has any views on that, but it is something very interesting because I do think that there's ways in which they're already picking up skills that could be radicalized, particularly humanity skills, right? I mean, one, they are so good, not necessarily at discernment, but processing information, incredibly so. Right. And they're also very good at having an idea of like, you know, oh, well, this site's going to say this and this site's going to say that. So already understanding genre and understanding the ways in which this creates very particular forms of communication. But I have found that when you try to get them to use that in a more critical, radical way, either for research and scholarship or for practice-based, active scholarship, that's been much harder. And maybe others are better at it. I don't know. It could just be. But it is figuring out how to use those inbuilt skills, many of which I think are humanities-based, if that makes sense.
Well, you know, Peter, I think you put your finger on it, which is, I think our role as teachers is really, at this moment, that sort of bridge building, which is really meeting people where they are, understanding what sort of skills and practices they possess. But understanding that those skills and practices have been cultivated within a capitalist world. And our job in many ways is to say, okay, you now have these skills, you have these interests. What would it be to actually move the point someplace else?
Yes.
And I think about William James. Mm-hmm. I threatened to bring him up and now I am. Yeah. So William James, the Americans, early psychologist and pragmatist philosopher in 1905, a year
and
before.
Brother of somebody?
Yeah, who is he, brother?
Who was Hank? Hank James, wasn't it?
Some obscure writer.
A character whose last name was Bloom. Who knows who that is?
a year before he dies. He gives a lecture to a bunch of Stanford students who are pacifists. and they want to mobilize against war, spread their news of pacifism. And he says, that's fine and good, but you have to understand that people support war for all sorts of laudatory reasons as well. Self-sacrifice, solidarity, commitment, and so on and so forth. And what you need to be able to do is meet people at those places and those spaces, and then create a moral alternative to those. And so how young people are actually kind of archiving and presenting and manufacturing and phantasmagorifying themselves mm-hmm. at this moment is all in the service of capital. It's all in the service of their own capitalization, the capitalization of themselves, cultural capital and social capital, fantasy capital, I guess we could add. But that doesn't mean it has to stay there, right?
Yeah.
Just means to understand that they're getting a great deal of pleasure out of this and they're building a bunch of skills. Our job is to say, what is the moral equivalent of that? Mm-hmm. How can you actually apply that to something which is going to make your life a lot better? And then maybe those skills will become less interesting in that new world, right? But those skills can get us there. I don't know how to do it yet, but I'm really excited. And I'll tell you what I'm most excited about, AI.
Yep.
Because it has taken the standard analytic essay off the table for us, because it can just be created by AI. And so, faced with that, I've had to rethink all of my assignments and move away from the sort of analysis model, the critique model, and start thinking about projects and about sort of problems and how people can actually maneuver from one sphere of expertise and apply it to a different problem, often as collectives. And so in some ways, AI has done kind of kicked my ass in such a way that's been really helpful into trying to rethink, after 35 years of this practice, how to be in the classroom and what do students need.
Well, and I think AI is very interesting, like generative AI in particular, for two reasons, exactly what you've said, which is, on the one hand, it actually is now unavoidable that, like, the contemporary subject is cyborg-esque, right? In the sense that, like, it's not about your own software and hardware, so to speak, right? Like, you will always have this kind of ecosystem of information and abilities. But it's also, it is, in many ways, it's a hegemony machine in the most interesting way, because you can actually ask it to give you an answer about something, and that represents, based on its database and also seeing of what is the dominant view. And you can actually get students to then say, okay, critically analyze, right, then what the hegemony is, right? And I think that's also something that, like, you know, we go back to Gramsci, that I think is often quite forgotten, is that, you know, we often assume that we know what the hegemony is, both in terms of historic blocks, but also in terms of the political common sense. And for him, I mean, I think he was pushing in a lot of ways to say, no, you have to continually discover it, because it is continually recomposing itself. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that when you go with AI, you see it is actually a set of intelligence for actually understanding what is the hegemonic intelligence right now and why. And getting students to think about that really, I think, is exciting. Like, I mean, and I think we're already thinking about our assessments, like put into ChatGPT, for instance, this question, see what it comes out, and now critically analyze it in terms of its dominant assumptions, mm-hmm. right? But what I've also found is that for academics, I would like us to begin thinking about our own practices a little bit more as labor. So what does it mean actually about writing, which I think we valorize quite a bit, as, you know, kind of like very special, but writing is labor, right? And what we've seen so far with, you know, whether is that what we've seen so far with digital technologies and things like that, is that it hasn't made our life and work less. Things like email has actually just caused us to have more intense forms of communicative labor and admin. So I, you know, there's a kind of, maybe it's my old school Marxist part of me, that I wish academics and students also thought very seriously about the fact that, like, no, generative AI is showing you, whether we like it or not, that writing is labor. And what are we going to do in a process of solidarity to use this as a tool for making, you know, I mean, making this labor less intensive, but certainly not allowing, right, the institutions that we're part of to make us more, to intense our work. I mean, we wrote a article, journalism, a colleague of Posse, Horn and I, in our group around this, was that you may not like it, but in 15 years or even 10 years, if it's the kind of thing where they expect you to write, you know, not your research, but do some of your writing even through AI, well, what's going to happen if that means that then they have a higher expectation of the amount of outputs that you do? And I think getting students, but also other academics to think about the question you've thought about, but also that we have to think about, which is, to go back, a business school question. Like, how are new technologies being used to increase or decrease your labor and the expectations around labor? And how is management being used as either a process for creating more access, right? You know, so, I mean, those are the kind of things that I think we try to also get our students to think about, you know? In their own way, they're, I mean, you know, to be fair, a lot of them are kind of like armchair Marxists without realizing it, because, you know, the whole plagiarism thing with AI is that they realize writing is labor, right? Like, they can reduce the amount of writing that they do. Like, they don't have the sense of romanticism or fetishism that I think most of us might have, you know, and that we sometimes don't historically contextualize ourselves in. I mean, for them, it's, if I can write 3,500 words in 10 minutes, I'm going to do it. Why would I spend, you know? I wonder then if maybe we could, because I don't know how much time we have, but maybe we could go around, but I would like to be interested in, because you talked about things, we've talked a lot about bringing ideas into the business school. And then you spoke about bringing business ideas into your kind of department, which is very interdisciplinary, but also your organization, right? I mean, and the kinds of ways in which there's a kind of business and culture, right? Do you think that in the U.S., which you've said is in many ways more neoliberal in a lot of sense, or there's less of things, that there's an opportunity to actually use to use these kinds of more radical ideas that we're trying to do in business school in the U.S.?
I think so. I mean, as probably the better people to ask would be my comrades at Baruch College, who I think have been doing this for the past 10 or 15 years. We in the U.S., particularly at the kind of level of college that Toby's talking about, which is sort of the rich schools and the elite schools, are not under the pressure that you all have been in the U.K., to sort of reduce the social sciences, reduce the humanities, and increase the business schools. So there's a very historical specificity to, I think, what happened in the UK that brought you to, I'm afraid to say, if you were in the US, you'd be safely ensconced in boring sociology and political departments, teaching Talcott Parsons to bored, you know, 19-year-olds. I don't think anybody teaches Talcott Parsons anymore, but in any case, and so I think that there's a historical specificity which is not reproducible in the United States, at least not at this level of college like NYU. It may be happening at the state universities. And if the right takes more control in the United States, we're going to see more and more of that, which is they identify, perhaps incorrectly, that the threat is the humanities and the social sciences, and their ally are the business school. It'll be fabulous to see them close those things down, expand the business schools, and perhaps we can radicalize our business schools by radicalizing them in the UK. Because I do think that there's actually a fertile ground there, partially because it is practical and it is project-based and it is solution-based, as opposed to the sort of endless debate, critique model of the humanities and a fair amount of the social sciences as well.
I mean, just go back for just a second. The reason why I was trying to bring back, I'm talking about Toby's book there, is I think that what we're doing is coming at that problematic from let's say the other side of it.
Yeah.
So if Toby's thing was about blowing up the humanities and to create a sort of more engaged, practical form of creative cultural studies knowledge, we're coming from the more the business management side to try to get back to where the, let's say meeting halfway in the mountain, if it makes any sense.
Yeah. I wish Toby's book was required reading for all humanities deans. But I'm afraid, Toby, that your vision has not been embraced by the humanities. And the humanities are actually quite reactionary, and are holding on as dearly as they can to their idea of them being a safe space for critique and defining themselves as being outside of society, not engaged with society. So I'm pessimistic that actually we can recreate the humanities and social sciences from within. I don't see any movement in that, for example, in my program. Jean Raela, my wife, who's doing this over in BMC, or the Media, Culture, and Communications Department. She's an adjunct. They've kind of put her and said, "We got to do something with these students. We don't want to be bothered with them. You do this, right?" And there's the spaces and places, I think, which are possible, but the dominant force is, keep theory separate from practice.
Which I would say the irony, the only place that that isn't the case is business schools.
Yeah,
I
and
mean, they're
the
dying
sciences.
for
Yeah,
it.
the sciences also, because of the laboratory model, I actually think have to work this way as well. But yeah.
Oh, that's, I think that's a really amazing, kind of inspiring place, maybe to analyze, because I feel like we could probably talk about this for another, or at least I could, for days or years, actually.
No, thanks very much, guys. I really appreciate the conversation. I think it's been absolutely wonderful. I just wonder before we depart whether any one of you on his own wants to add anything to what's already been said. Looks.
Well, oh, sorry. I think my thing is going up.
I'm just going to suggest a title for the episode, which would be "The Thing That Brings Together Gramsci with Allen Iverson Is We're Talking About Praxis."
Lovely. Well, two Steves and one Peter later. Thank you both. Thank you all very, very much. It's been great chatting.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Toby. As always, wonderful speaking with you and everyone.